Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest and greatest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I am your host, as always, Phil Lanides, and alongside me is absolutely nobody. Unfortunately, Josh and I recorded this or recorded the episode last night, but there was an issue. That's the unfortunate part. And we had some mic problems. And so Josh was sadly unable to schedule some time to re-record. So I am going to do this solo. First time that I'm doing an event episode by myself, but this is a very interesting Strikeforce event to cover. I know it well, so I think we're going to have some fun here. Before we move forward, I just want to welcome everybody to the show. Inside the Hexagon is about walking through the major events, fighters, and milestones of Strikeforce, which was a very important and innovative MMA promotion that existed from 2006 until 2013. And on this episode, we are going to be discussing Strikeforce Diaz versus Daly, which took place on April 9th, 2011, at the Valley View Casino Center in San Diego, California. In the main event, Strikeforce welterweight champion Nick Diaz would put his title on the line against challenger Paul Semtex Daly. In the co-main event, Gilbert Melendez would return after about a year away from the cage to defend his belt against Japanese superstar Tatsuya Kawajiri in a rematch. Also on the card, we would see Gegard Mousasi make his return against the Dean of Mean, Keith Jardine, and then also Lyle Fancy Pants Beerbomb would take a big step up in competition against Japanese submission ace Shinya Aoki. I want to mention that Inside the Hexagon is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. You can check out the other shows on the network at evergreenpodcast.com. All right, the fallout from Strikeforce, Feijão versus Henderson is the previous major Strikeforce event. Dan Henderson had brutalized Feijão Cavalcante in the main event to take his light heavyweight title, further cementing his legacy as an all-time MMA great. Also on the card, Marluse Kunin survived Liz Carmouche, and I mean that. She survived her. She barely got a submission in the fourth round to keep her bantamweight belt. Carmouche dominated the vast majority of the fight, and Kunin just, I mean, she came through at the end there. Pretty crazy. We also saw Tim Kennedy submit Melvin Manhoef, as well as Jorge Masvidal take on Billy Evangelista and win a rather lackluster decision. I did want to mention, if you haven't already, make sure you check out my interview with Tim Kennedy in the archives. Really great connecting with him, and I hope that if you did listen to it, that you enjoyed it. All right, so originally, this April 9th event was planned to feature the next set of heavyweight Grand Prix bouts. And they were also expecting the return of KJ Nunes. He had been out since breaking his hand in a title loss to Nick Diaz the previous year. However, both the Grand Prix bouts and KJ Nunes would be moved to later dates. Instead, we would get the aforementioned Diaz versus Daly card, or would we? Because on March 12th, less than 1 month before Diaz versus Daly, we got one of the biggest Strikeforce announcements, really maybe one of the biggest MMA announcements in history, and that is that Strikeforce had been sold by Scott Coker and his partners at the Silicon Valley Sports and Entertainment Group to Zuffa, which at the time was the parent company of the UFC. It's never been confirmed, but the dollar figure put on the deal, and it's accepted by many journalists out there that, and this was including licensing rights, fighter contracts, and the Strikeforce video library, put that dollar figure at $40 million. I remember personally being pretty bummed out about this as I felt like as a Strikeforce fan, I kind of felt like I'd been sold out a little bit. I also lost a stream of income from the deal as my agreement with Strikeforce ended at that time as well. I talked with Josh about this same thing on his side, that he'd lost a stream of income. And then just, again, we were both big fans of Strikeforce. It was a passion project for both of us. And so that was difficult. But there were others that were worried as well that had higher stakes or, you know, more skin in the game. Some Strikeforce fighters, such as the headliners for this event that we're discussing, Nick Diaz and Paul Daly, they both had strained relationships with Dana White and the UFC. In fact, Daly tweeted, quote, "Business as usual. What if I don't want to fight for Dana White / Zuffa? Dana White bans me for life from the UFC, then buys Strikeforce and thinks I'm still going to be easy and fight on one of the most anticipated fights of the year versus Diaz, which will no doubt make Zuffa Dana White money. Diaz or Daly versus Diaz still on? Somebody better holler at my manager real quick." So obviously whatever happened there did get worked out because Daly did compete. But it is worth mentioning that at least one Strikeforce fighter was excited about the acquisition, and that was lightweight champ Gilbert Melendez. He had, if I remember correctly, he had actually spoken to the media about possibly going to the UFC at some point. He really wanted to test himself. And so he also mentioned in an interview around this time that the acquisition gave him extra motivation for his bout with Tatsuya Kawajiri, because that would give him a chance that if he won, that, you know, he might get some higher profile fights and some bigger name fights and be able to prove that he's the best 155er in the world, which he may have been at that time. Dana White was also interviewed around this time. He confirmed that Strikeforce would be kept separate from the UFC, and that while some UFC fighters might sign with Strikeforce if they wanted to, we would not be seeing super fights. We would not be seeing the big, you know, the champion of the UFC versus the champion of Strikeforce. But I do want to mention, for more of a deep dive on this deal and what it meant to MMA then and what it means now, make sure you check out our previous episode. It was a sit-down interview between me and longtime MMA reporter John Morgan. John is a friend of mine. We go way back. I had a great time breaking down this acquisition. Again, what it meant to the fighters, what it meant to the sport as a whole, and how it's viewed today, as well as his overall perspective on Strikeforce. And so that was a great chat. So again, if you haven't already, make sure that you check that out in the archives. Another big announcement around this time was that Gina Carano was signed, sealed, and delivered to be coming back to Strikeforce. I had forgotten about this, but she was actually scheduled to fight on the June Strikeforce card against Sarah De Alelio. This was pretty surprising because Dana White had been very clear at that point that he would never, ever promote women's MMA. He changed his mind. But now that Strikeforce was under the Zuffa banner, some thought that this might be the death knell for major female fights. Again, we all know that would prove not to be the case, and Carano would come back. Carano coming back was a positive sign, and we will talk more about that. All right, there was a Challengers event around this time. Challengers Wilcox versus Dom took place on April 1st. 2011 at the Stockton Arena in Stockton, California. Not a ton of notable names on this one. Lorenz Larkin TKO'd former kickboxing star Scott Leidy in the second round. Karis Fodor TKO'd David Douglas in the third round. And in the main event, AKA fighter Justin Wilcox TKO'd Rodrigo Dom at the end of the first round. All right, but this brings us to the event that we're here to talk about. Strikeforce Diaz versus Daly again took place April 9th, 2011 at the Valley View Casino Center in San Diego, California. Gus Johnson was back for this one, unfortunately, but he was teamed up once again with Mauro Ranallo and Frank Shamrock. Broadcasted on Showtime, Diaz versus Daly drew slightly better ratings than Feijão versus Henderson, with the former drawing an average of 528,000 viewers, while the latter drew an average of 412,000. However, both were well short of Fedor versus Silva, which held the record for a Showtime broadcast for Strikeforce, which drew an average of 741,000 viewers. So once the broadcast kicked off, Mauro Ranallo interviewed Scott Coker, I mean, before they got to any fights, and asked him about the acquisition. And Coker said it was a real tough decision, but it had been in the works for a while. Coker said they still had their own fighters, their own broadcast contract, and their own events, but now had Zuffa's promotional muscle behind them. He deemed it Strikeforce 3.0, which I assume Strikeforce 1.0 was their kickboxing phase, and then once they moved to MMA, that was 2.0, and now this was 3.0. He said there were talks to expand it to Canada and beyond. Coker also say that while Strikeforce and the UFC would continue to operate separately, he did expect to see championship dream fights such as Alistair Overeem versus Cain Velasquez and Gilbert Melendez versus Frankie Edgar. So interesting that Coker said that. Dana said that would not be happening. So, you know, we did not end up seeing that. We just saw the UFC start to siphon Strikeforce fighters away. And we'll talk more about that actually in this podcast, because that started to happen as soon as this event was over, pretty much. But so Dana, by the way, despite earlier comments that indicated that he would not be in attendance, he was cage side, apparently. They said had to put extra pressure on the fighters as they had the opportunity to make an impression one way or the other on the biggest promoter in MMA. And, you know, would that play a factor in any of the fights? We would see. But let's go over the undercard. At 145 pounds, Robbie Peralta defeated Hiroyuki Takaya via split decision. At 265 pounds, heavyweight Virgil Swicker defeated Brett Albee via TKO, come by way of strikes at 146 of the first round. At lightweight, Joe Duarte defeated Saeed Awad via submission, come by way of armbar at 245 of the second round. Saeed, longtime Bellator fighter. At welterweight, Herman Toredo defeated AJ Matthews via KO, come by way of punch at 416 of the first round. At a catchweight of 140 pounds, Rolando Perez defeated Edgar Cardenas via unanimous decision. And then at middleweight, Casey Ryan defeated Paul Song via submission, come by way of triangle choke at 139 of the first round. All right, let's get to the main card. Here we go. So at 155 pounds, Shinya Aoki took on Lyle Beerbohm. Aoki was 26-5. He was the dream lightweight champion coming in. He had won six of his last seven MMA bouts, with the one loss coming to Gilbert Melendez in Strikeforce in Nashville. Mauro pointed out that Aoki was back, wanted revenge against Gil, but he had to get through Fancy Pants first. And it's worth mentioning, Shinya Aoki, and this was Josh actually mentioned this during the recording that we did yesterday, that Shinya came out to a big crowd response. And it was, you know, pretty crazy for a San Diego crowd to respond that, you know, strongly to a native Japanese fighter, didn't speak English, didn't really have any big U.S. ties, but he apparently had a following there. This was right around the time of the massive Japanese earthquake that happened in Japan back then, and just there was all kinds of devastation. I vaguely remember that. I don't know a lot about it, but the commentators made, you know, they discussed that a little bit, and Aoki and Kawajiri both got, you know, seemed to get emotional, and it was a pretty big deal. So, but Beerbohm was 16-1 coming in, which included a 3-1 record in Strikeforce. A lot of his wins were against unheralded competition, but he did have stoppage wins over UFC vets like Gerald Strebent and Rafaelo Oliveira, as well as wins in Strikeforce over Dwayne Bang Ludwig and Vitor Shaolin Ribeiro. So he was no joke. Then he, you know, as he's on this big run, he was 16-0, and then he had actually lost his most recent fight. It was a decision to the very, very tough Pat Healy. So that was his first career setback, but he was still given this massive opportunity to fight one of the best lightweights in the world in Shinya Aoki. And I have to mention, we have talked about Lyle a little bit on this podcast. Again, if you don't remember, I did sponsorships for him for a while and actually managed him as a fighter for a while there. And he has a really amazing story. He got into drugs in the, I believe, the early 2000s, specifically meth, committed several felonies over the course of 6 years, and he got time in prison. He actually got a year in state prison. And while he was in state prison, he saw the UFC on TV and thought, man, I could do that. And on the day of his release, he had his dad take him to a gym on the way home so he could check it out, and started training immediately, had his first amateur fight 8 days after his release from state prison. He went 10-0 as an amateur before turning pro in 2007 and running his record to 16-0 again heading into 2011. Then he had that loss to Healy. But he had really had an amazing, amazing story. He was featured in a documentary, I believe it's called Fight Life, in I think 2012 or 2013, and just a crazy story. And we'll get to that a little bit more in just a few minutes. But Lyle's pants for the fight itself, they were not quite as fancy as they were patriotic. Normally had a lot of the 90s, you know, kind of chevrons and just different, you know, neon colors and that sort of thing. But this time they were covered with small American flag emblems. So once the bell rang, Beerbohm clinched early on, but Aoki was able to turn that around and get a trip takedown. And this was really the beginning of the end, as the Japanese submission fighter was able to get Beerbohm's back and sink in a neck crank. And I mean, my God, it was on tight. And that was all she wrote. Beerbohm was forced to tap. Essentially, it looks like a rear naked choke, but the forearm is across the jaw and the chin with the head being turned. And it looked very, very painful. So the official result was Shinya Aoki defeating Lyle Beerbohm via submission, come by way of face or neck crank at 133 of the first round. And, you know, just not a smart game plan for Lyle. You know, not that Lyle was known for being a great striker. He was just kind of an all-around fighter, but wrestling seemed to be mostly his base. And, you know, why would you go to the ground with a guy that's where he's going to beat you? And, you know, probably should have kept things standing. And just Josh also pointed out just kind of a weird strategy. And just, I mean, it was a mismatch. Lyle's experience level was not on that of a guy like Shinya Aoki, and talent level and all that stuff. But, you know, man. But as soon as the fight was over, my God, there it was. They showed Dana White on camera smiling, wearing a Strikeforce T-shirt. And just an image I never thought I'd see. Stings a little bit to see it, you know, even now as I was prepping for this. And they also showed Lorenzo Fertitta, Dominic Cruz, Jake Shields, and Nate Diaz from the UFC. They actually showed Gilbert and Jake in there, the scrap pack all together in the locker room. And Just kind of crazy to see all those guys. Dominic, at least, I don't know if he's actually from San Diego, but that's, he was based there, so it made sense for him to be there. But just a surreal moment to see these guys all together, and just kind of crazy. But despite, I want to mention, you know, as far as what happened, the aftermath, what happened after the fight and everything that kind of went down there. So we, you know, despite the rematch for, the desire for a rematch with Gilbert Melendez, this would be it for Shinya Aoki and Strikeforce. Today, he's still active at 38 years old. He won the ONE FC welterweight title in 2019, then dropped it to Christian Lee in his next bout. And he is 2-0 in 2021 as we record this in November. Overall, his record stands at 47-9-1 in MMA, which means since his win over Fancy Pants, and I apologize if my math is wrong here, but if my math is right, since this fight, he is 20-4 in mixed martial arts, with three of those losses coming to Eddie Alvarez, Ben Askren, and the aforementioned Christian Lee. So that's that's nobody to hang your head into, you know, nobody to hang your head at as far as losing to. And he's beaten the likes of Razor Rob McCullough, Antonio McKee, and then one of my all-time favorites and kind of the predecessor to Shinya Aoki. If you're a Pride fan, you probably know who I'm talking about, Kazushi Sakuraba. And then he's beaten a bunch of others, obviously, but very impressive run for Aoki. Unfortunately, not nearly as impressive would be as what's happened to Fancy Pants since his time in Strikeforce. This was actually his last fight with the promotion as well. But he would go 9-1 over the remainder of his career, which included a win over Marcus Aurelio. The lone loss came to a very tough Jacob Volkman. The other fights, I didn't recognize any of any of the other guys he beat. So a lot of regional stuff up in the Pacific Northwest where he's from. But Beerbohm last fought in 2013, going out on a 3-fight win streak that all came via stoppage. But sadly, it seems like Lyle has fallen back into addiction. He got arrested for drugs and burglary in 2016, and then got arrested, as we record this again, in November of 2021, almost exactly a year ago. He got arrested again for possession of drugs. I know that he has a young child. I don't know how he's been doing over the last year. I hope and pray that he's, you know, begun to turn things around once again. He's still only 42 years old and obviously has a lot of life in front of him if he can get things straightened out. But, you know, just obviously for his daughter and everything, and he's a good guy. So, thoughts and prayers with Lyle, and I hope that he is doing better as we record this. All right, in the next bout, light heavyweight Gegard Mousasi versus Keith Jardine. Originally, this was supposed to be Mousasi taking on Mike Kyle, but Kyle broke his hand in training, so Jardine stepped in on less than 2 weeks' notice, and that would come into play here. We'll talk about that. The Dean of Mean, Keith Jardine, one of my all-time favorite nicknames in MMA. I just, the Dean of Mean, Keith Jardine. I mean, that's just cool. I love that. But he was 17-9-1 coming in, which as we're recording this, I noticed, you know, Shinya Aoki is 47-9-1. Keith Jardine is 17-9-1. So those last two numbers are the same, but 30 win difference in that first one. But coming into this one, Jardine was on a modest 2-fight win streak. Neither of those wins came over what I would call stellar competition. Before that, he'd lost 6 of his last 7, with his lone win coming via split decision over Brandon Vera in the UFC 2.5 years prior to this. His losses had come at the hands of Vanderlei Silva, Rampage Jackson, Thiago Silva, Ryan Bader, Matt Hamill, and Trevor Prangley. So, I mean, big name guys. But, you know, again, he'd gone down in defeat to all of them. But still a very tough fighter with wins over Forrest Griffin and Chuck Liddell, which the Liddell one, I believe, was a decision win. That was the biggest of his career. He badly needed another win here. For Mousasi's part, this was his first fight in Strikeforce since losing the light heavyweight title to King Mo. He was 30 wins, 3 losses, and one draw. He was still one of the elite for sure. He was coming off 2 MMA wins and 1 kickboxing win. Mousasi was supposed to take on Mike Kyle, as I mentioned, but Kyle had been injured, so the Dutchman would take on the very unorthodox Keith Jardine instead. All right, man, very weird to see Jardine's UFC footage used as part of a Strikeforce pre-fight video package. I mean, it's cool, but hearing, you know, Mike Goldberg and Joe Rogan on commentary there during the video package was interesting. And Mauro pointed out Jardine's very herky-jerky style, again, very unorthodox. If you remember watching him fight, he was just always super herky-jerky. He moved a lot, and it must have been very weird to prepare for, to find training partners that could imitate that and then just to deal with it in the cage. But lots of action in the first round. Good strikes and early Jardine takedown that Mousasi stood up from almost immediately. To kind of provide some context here, you know, Mousasi in that loss to King Mo, he just got taken down repeatedly. He didn't eat a lot of damage, but he just kept getting taken down. And, you know, that means something in the judge's eyes. And so this time, and they were saying that Mousasi had just stayed on his back too much. This time he got taken down, but he was able to stand right back up. And then he got taken down again, stood back up again. The two traded on their feet with Mousasi getting the better of the exchange. Jardine looked hurt and winded already in the first round, but he survived, got another takedown, which was his fourth of that opening frame. Now, interesting, this time Mousasi was able to reverse. I'm sorry, Mousasi was able to get a strike in from his back. He threw an up kick while on his back, and the ref stopped it. Now, the interesting thing is that Strikeforce was now under Zuffa rules. Under Strikeforce rules, the up kick would have been allowed, but under Zuffa rules, it was not. Now, we would also see another new rule come into play in a later fight, which was no elbows to the head of a grounded opponent. That was not allowed in Strikeforce. Well, that was now going to be allowed because of the Zuffa rule. So this was now, this upkick was now illegal. Time was called. And I, on replay, you could see he did nail Jardine. He really did nail Jardine. The ref gave Jardine, Mike Beltran, the ref gave Jardine a chance to recover, which he took full advantage of. I'm sure the strike hurt, but he was also, again, very winded. The crowd did not like this at all. And then the crowd booed even harder when referee Mike Beltran took a point away. It was kind of a weird sequence. And personally, especially with the way this fight ended up, I am not a fan of that point being taken away. It was clearly an accident. It was not something that was done intentionally. He definitely, you know, hurt Jardine, and I don't know how much damage there was there, but to me, especially with a new rule set, I mean, why not give them an opportunity? Why not give him a warning? If he does something like that again, then take a point away. You know, say, if you break the rules again, I don't care what it is, you're getting the point taken away. But to just on that first one to take a point away, I thought that was, I didn't think it was fair. I didn't like that at all. But Mousasi was just, you know, as the round was, you know, as the fight was restarted in the first, just blasting Jardines with strikes and all that. But then he got caught with a big knee that appeared to cut him. Jardine was cut around both his eyes as the round ended. And it was a great first round. Lots of action, really tough to score. Despite the four takedowns, because Jardine did so little with them and was getting beat up other than that, I'd probably call this 10-9 for Mousasi because of the damaging strikes, but because of the point that got taken away, it would end up being a 9-9 round, excuse me, in my mind. So we get to the second round. Mousasi, I mean, he is just tagging Jardine with strikes, and the Dinamine was starting to bleed pretty heavily, and his baby version of Jim the Anvil Neidhart's goatee was turning blood red. It was pretty crazy. But despite being clearly very winded and bleeding badly, Jardine was able to withstand, got a takedown late in the round. However, with all the damage from the strikes, I'd give it to Mousasi 10-9 in the second round. In the third, huge deep breaths from Jardine at the beginning of that final frame. Shortly after they started fighting, Mousasi nailed Jardine in the cup with a knee, which got another time stoppage. No point taken away on this one. After a short break, things were restarted. Jardine actually seemed to get a second wind here, probably having that short break. He was pressing for more takedowns. However, it was Mousasi who got a takedown, and he got a very stiff guillotine choke from the feet, almost like a hanging guillotine. But the very tough Keith Jardine was able to poke his head out. Then he got taken down again. Mousasi got full mount pretty quickly and landed a couple shots. But Jardine, who was clearly the crowd favorite, was able to walk his feet up the cage and get Mousasi off him. It was actually pretty impressive, especially with how tired he was. Then it looked like Jardine either spit his mouthpiece out or he was just breathing with his mouth open and the mouthpiece came out, got another stoppage. Mousasi nailed Jardine with a brutal 1-2. I mean, he was just killing Jardine on the feet, who was bleeding like a stuck pig. I don't know how he survived, but he did make it to the end of the fight. But man, what a fight. Other than the multiple time stoppages, I really enjoyed this fight. It was a true war. Mousasi dominated the final two rounds. I mean, maybe you could give that first round to Jardine, like I said, with the takedowns, but to me that's debatable since he didn't really do any damage with them. Again, Beltran shouldn't have taken a point away from the upkick like he did, but especially because in the end, it cost Mousasi the fight. It shouldn't have. He dominated the majority of this fight, but the official result was two of the judges scored it a draw, which meant they actually scored it for Mousasi 2-1. But because of that point being taken away, he got the draw, and then one judge did score it for Mousasi. So it ended in a majority draw. Very unfortunate. Jardine on the post, on the mic in the post fight interview mentioned, just kind of quoted good old JR. It's kind of like, draws are like kissing your sister. Nobody really wins. But if it did make him feel any better, he did get a hug and some words of encouragement from Bill Goldberg cage side afterwards. So Mousasi, in my estimation, won the fight. It was unfortunate the way that it turned out. But this is definitely a fight worth watching, in my opinion. Jardine would be back. He would earn another opportunity in Strikeforce the following year, while Mousasi would compete in Dream before returning to the Hexagon before the end of 2011. All right, we have arrived at the co-main event, Gilbert Melendez versus Tatsuya Kawajiri for the Strikeforce Lightweight Championship. Gilbert Melendez was 18-2 coming in, but had not fought in almost exactly a year. He was on a four-fight winning streak, having last beaten Shinya Aoki the previous April. This was a rematch, as Melendez had beaten Kawajiri via unanimous decision in Pride in 2006, 5 years prior. And in an interview with MMA Weekly, Gilbert stated that he was actually happy to take on a rematch of a bout that he'd already won, as he felt like he was a completely different fighter from that fight half a decade before. And he wanted to be able to show that off. So he was actually excited for this bout. Kawajiri, who was 27-6-2, had won five of his last six bouts, with his lone loss coming to Aoki via submission in Japan the previous year, which I did find that fight on YouTube. And it's a fairly quick one. They got to the ground pretty quick, and they tried to trade leg locks, and eventually Aoki was able to cinch one in, and Kawajiri tapped out. But he had rebounded with a decision win over Josh Thompson 4 months before this event, so he seemed really primed. That was in Japan, and he seemed really primed to get revenge in a major title from Melendez. And this was also Kawajiri's North American debut, so that's a big deal. He had a shot at making a big splash in a new market for him. All right, once the action started, Melendez dropped Kawajiri with a beautiful counter right hand early on, which you could, I wrote out, it seemed to give him a lot of confidence. Just in that moment, you could see him gain confidence from that. He also got a couple of nice knees in, which drew a huge reaction from the crowd. The champ landed another really solid knee, and the Japanese fighter was clearly hurt. Melendez pounced, grabbing Kawajiri's back and throwing strikes right in front of Dana White cage side. It was such a cool camera angle that you could just see Dana. He was right there. Literally inches away as Melendez was raining down strikes, and pretty nice. But then they end up getting back up. They separate. You could see Kawajiri had not cleared the cobwebs, and good Lord, after eating a couple more strikes, he shot in for a takedown. Melendez was able to sprawl and push Kawajiri on his back. And from there he threw, like I said, new rules would come into play. Those elbows, he threw some elbows to the head of a downed opponent that, again, would not have been allowed in Strikeforce previously, but Kawajiri, under Suzuka rules, he ate him, and he ate him bad. Melendez dropped a few heavy ones to Kawajiri's dome, and that was it. He earned the stoppage. I did think, when I saw it, the ref stopped it a little bit early, but Kawajiri did not protest. He was too busy recovering flat on his back. So big, big win for the champ, and the crowd went crazy. Very, very nice win for him. So the official result, Gilbert Melendez defeated Tatsuya Kawajiri via TKO, come by way of elbows, at 3:14 of the first round to retain the Strikeforce Lightweight Championship. And in his post-fight interview, Gil said he wanted to unify the Strikeforce title with the UFC belt, which the crowd reacted positively to. And Gil versus Frankie Edgar in 2011 would have been an amazing fight. Melendez would be back to defend his title against Jorge Masvidal in December, while Kawajiri would be one and done with Strikeforce. He went on to have a decent run with the UFC before heading back to Japan to fight for Ryzen. I'm not going to call him retired, but the 43-year-old last fought in October of 2019, so over 2 years ago, 2 years ago as we record this. He holds a record of 37-14-2. All right, we have arrived at the main event, Nick Diaz versus Paul Daly for Diaz's Strikeforce Welterweight Championship. Diaz was 24-7. He was on a 9-fight win streak coming into this bout, which included wins in Strikeforce over Frank Shamrock, Scott Smith, Marius Aromskis, KJ Nunes, and Cyborg Santos. With the Zuffa deal, people had to be thinking about Diaz versus GSP, which was You know, that would have been a massive, massive fight at that time. We would eventually see that fight, but a strong showing here in front of Dana White would go a long way towards making that happen. Also, Daly, 27-9-2 coming in. This was an opportunity for him to become the first British fighter to ever hold a major MMA title. But he had won all four of his bouts since being banned from the UFC for punching Josh Koscheck after the bell. One of those victories was his brutal one-punch knockout of Scott Smith that Josh never wants to talk about again. Diaz, I mean, he was on a roll for sure, but so was Semtex, and he presented a very dangerous foe for the champ. All right, big boos for Daly as he came to the cage, and as you would expect, huge cheers for the California native Nick Diaz. Huge stare down between the two in the cage right before the bell, with them briefly touching foreheads and Diaz talking smack while Semtex just smiled at him. But Diaz immediately started talking to Daly once the fight started, fainting and dropping his hands. Semtex got in closer and it looked like Diaz dropped to shoot in, and Daly threw some wild strikes, even kicking the champ in the side, which was risky, as if he'd connected with Diaz's head, that would have been an illegal strike. And with these referees, they probably would have taken a point away, if not just gone the DQ route. But Diaz withstood, got things back to his feet, pushed things against the cage. There was a lot of dirty boxing before Diaz separated, landed some really nice punches that appeared to hurt Daly. And Semtex actually shot the guy who is not a wrestler at all. He shot in out of desperation with Diaz going with it and wrapping Daly up. However, they stood back up, and Daly looked like he'd recovered. These two were just, I mean, they began trading, just banging, giving the crowd quite a show. With a minute and a half left in the round, Daly landed a left to the temple, and Diaz was rocked and dropped. Semtex tried to follow up, and he looked like he had the champion in trouble. Referee John McCarthy was checking in with Diaz, but he responded that he was fine, and Daly ended up backing up and letting Diaz get up, which was probably smart. So with 30 seconds left, Daly was hurt with a right hand from Diaz. Now, the commentators didn't catch it, but Daly sure did, and he was rocked, and the two started trading. The champ was getting the better of it. He got caught and cut, but he smelled blood and kept pressing. Daly fell over very awkwardly. If you ever get to watch this fight, it's one of the weirdest, like when somebody gets knocked off their feet, because it was really delayed. It was very weird. Diaz pounced, started throwing punches from the top until the ref stepped in, and Daly seemed to disagree, but he was really out of it, and it looked like a good stoppage. And so, I mean, just 3 seconds left in the round. Diaz, though, he was not ready to stop afterwards. He pushed a camera out of the way in a very famous clip of footage that you've probably seen before. He went over, started pointing his finger close to Daly's face, who, again, was just kind of out of it, and an official pulled Diaz away, and Cesar Gracie seemed to have a calming effect on Diaz. He you know, once he was able to get in the cage, he kind of grabbed him around the shoulder and started speaking in his ear, and that was probably a really good thing. And eventually Diaz did go over and eventually shake Daly's hand. But the official result, Nick Diaz defeated Paul Daly via TKO, come by way of punches at 4:57 of the first round to retain the Strikeforce Welterweight Championship. Semtex would be back to take on Tyron Woodley just a few months after this bout, but this would be it for Nick Diaz inside the Hexagon. I did not realize that this was his last Strikeforce fight. He would vacate his title and transition over to the UFC. He was actually supposed to take on George St. Pierre for the welterweight title. Instead, he would be pulled from that bout due to missing flights and press obligations, and he would instead take a decision win over BJ Penn. But just to give you context and perspective on Nick Diaz, at this point, he's 28 years old. Since that, not this point now, but at the point in 2011 that we're discussing, since that 2011 win over BJ Penn, Nick Diaz has only fought four times in MMA, and that's including his stoppage loss to Robbie Lawler at UFC 266 in September of 2021, which is his first fight in is either 6 or 7 years. But think about that. He had won 11 straight victories. The last two were over BJ Penn and Paul Daly, plus all the names I mentioned earlier. He was only 28 at that time. Since that time, his peak at 38 years old now, he has only fought four times, and he lost all four of those fights. One of the fights, the loss to Anderson Silva, got overturned. But just kind of crazy. And Josh and I spoke about this when we recorded yesterday. I believe that Nick has some personality issues, mental health issues, that he's undiagnosed anxiety or pain. I don't know that he's ever been diagnosed with anything like that, but just based on the interviews he's done and a lot of the things that he's talked about, I just feel like he's deals with a lot of issues in his mind. And that's not a knock. That's not, you know, I'm not in any way trying to make light of anything or say anything negative about him. I just personally believe, based on the footage that I've seen, the, you know, the stories I've read, the different things that I've come across, that he deals with a lot of, you know, a lot of issues in that. And so, you know, that would contribute to why we've only seen him, despite being only 28 and one of the top lightweights in the world, only compete those four times since that win over Penn. I mean, I just think that's kind of crazy. So, but that brings us to the end of this event. I want to give the wrap up details. No fighters pop for drugs of abuse or performance enhancers after the event. The total disclosed fighter payroll was $769,740. And I want to mention, when I interviewed John Morgan, Josh and I have both gone on and on at times about the fighter pay, that it's just unfair the way that fighters were paid, especially back then, but even now. And so I asked John, you know, because all we really have to go off of are these fighter salaries that are released through the local state athletic commission. And I asked John, how accurate are these? And this guy's been covering MMA for years and years. And he said that they're not very accurate at all. He said that due to tax reasons, fighters will often only get paid a certain amount for their fight, but then have a separate kind of secret quote unquote contract for a quote unquote appearance fee that is much higher. So the fighter salaries that we share likely do not include the full amounts that the fighters are paid. Now, of course, there are some that probably don't get, you know, that extra money, so to speak, or whatever, but we have no way of knowing. We do know that George St. Pierre mentioned recently, I believe his disclosed pay was like $500,000 for a fight or something, like a pay-per-view fight or something like that. And he said he got like $10 million for that fight, or, you know, so it's, that obviously, confirms that, you know, that those fighter contracts are not, you know, are not accurate, and, or those, you know, yeah, at least what we see from there. So, yeah. Okay. Here we go. So George St. Pierre said that for the fight with Michael Bisping in 2019, with the pay-per-views, the sponsorships, everything, he said he made about $10 million. So that was a very, very different, you know, that's just much different than what he was said to have paid as far as based on what the athletic commission, that type of information. So take these salaries with a grain of salt is my point. But Nick Diaz, according to the athletic commission, got $175,000 with no win bonus. Paul Daly got $65,000. Gilbert Melendez, $150,000 with no win bonus. Tatsuya Kawajiri got $97,612.50. I did want to mention Shinya Aoki got $73,637.50. I'm assuming that those are kind of weird numbers like they are because they were the yen, that like in where they come from in Japan and the type of currency they normally use, yen would, you know, it probably translated to an even round number, you know, with them. But anyways, Gegard Mousasi got $150,000 for his draw with Keith Jardine, who got $25,000, and then Lyle Beerbohm got $10,000. But very momentous card in Strikeforce history. Really enjoyable card overall. To me, my favorite fight was actually the Mousasi Jardine fight. Very entertaining from start to finish. Great performances from Aoki, Mousasi, Jardine, Melendez, Daly, and Diaz. Josh, when I asked him about this, he said he really enjoyed the show as well, even though it was tough, being, you know, knowing that Dana was there and it was the end of an era. But really, just a really, really enjoyable card overall. There's a pall over it. It kind of cast a pall knowing that this was the end of an era, not just for Strikeforce, but for MMA as a whole. Again, John Morgan and I talked about this on the previous episode, but Strikeforce was never a real competitor to the UFC. It was an alternative for fighters to go that, you know, maybe they just didn't want to be in the UFC, or the UFC didn't want them, and there was an opportunity there to go make some money elsewhere. You know, could Strikeforce have survived and still be in business today? Maybe if they'd stayed a big time regional promotion, you know, maybe, but it's just, obviously it's tough to say. They were talking about expanding anyways. So, but most of their shows outside that didn't, especially those that didn't feature Fedor outside of the Bay Area, didn't sell nearly as well as they did in the Bay Area. And, you know, there were a staff of 10 people. This was not, you know, Josh and I worked for them as contractors. I'm sure they had a bunch of other contractors working for them, but it was a staff of about 10 people. And so they just didn't have the, you know, the depth. They didn't have the resources of a larger company at that point, like the UFC, which was again pulling in, you know, multi-million dollar gates and pay-per-view buys and all kinds of, they just, it was on a different level. So you could understand why the decision was made, even though it was kind of frustrating. And again, if you want to hear more about that, check out my interview with John Morgan. But, you know, just if you haven't already, make sure that you check that out. In our next episode, we are going to be covering Strikeforce Overeem versus Verdun, which featured four heavyweight Grand Prix bouts, as well as a lightweight bout between KJ Nunes and Jorge Masvidal. In the Grand Prix, we'd get to see Chad Griggs take on Valentine Overeem. This will be covering Daniel Cormier battling Jeff Monson. Josh Barnett locked horns with Brett Rogers, and Alistair Overeem went up against Fabricio Verdun in the main event. Again, as mentioned earlier, this card was supposed to feature the return of Gina Carano, but that would not end up happening. We'll talk about why during that episode, but I am looking forward to covering this one. But I do want to, again, apologize for just being me. I hope that you were okay with this. At least it was shorter than it normally is. But I hope that you enjoyed this. You make sure you can check us out on social media. You can find me on Twitter and on Instagram at the Hexagon Pod. And then you can find me at Phil. You can reach me directly at phil@insidethehexagon.com. I would love to hear from you. But with that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. We hope that you stay safe and you stay healthy, and we will see you soon.
In a world infatuated with comic fandom, comes a show to help us remember the talents that have inspired us.
Whoa, cut.
Oh, come on, it wasn't that bad.
It's a bit dramatic. Let's just tell them about the show, guys.
We are the Canned Air Podcast.
Join us weekly for a comedic trip through pop culture.
We also welcome some cool comic creators, as well as some of the voice and screen actors that helped shape your childhood.
Find us on CannedAirPodcast.com and on the Evergreen Podcast Network.